Hello and welcome to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. We're talking to leaders across the cell and gene therapy industry and telling you more about Ori's mission to manufacture brighter futures. I'm Jason Foster, the CEO of Ori Biotech, and I'll be the host for today's podcast. Hello and welcome to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Foster. Today we are lucky to have John Lee. John is the Senior Vice President and Head of Cell Therapy at the Center for Breakthrough Medicines. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for inviting me.
How are things outside of Philly today?
Yes, outside of Philly, it's a little cold, dark, some snow on the ground this morning. Typical February weather. So
I was going to say, on February 1st, we're all experiencing the same gray doldrums. So
yeah,
not that different in London. So you're not missing out on much over here, that's for sure. Would love to maybe start out a bit with your background. You've spent many years in cell and gene therapy and research and academia and industry, and I'd love to know more about kind of how your journey led you to science and then ultimately how you got into cell and gene therapy at CBM.
Sure. So I've had I'm a PhD scientist by training. Cancer cell biologist is how I would describe myself. That has ranged anywhere from small molecules early in my career to large molecules. And eventually for the past 10 years or so, I've been working exclusively in the world of cell therapy. Started off at Janssen Therapeutics before Janssen was, long before they in-licensed Carvykti from Legend. Mm-hmm. I built out their internal CAR-T capabilities there before transitioning over to GlaxoSmithKline, where I was the head of oncology cell therapy research unit, managing their portfolio from early discovery through phase one trials, which included their lete-cel asset that recently went back to Adaptimmune. Mm-hmm. And then more recently, I made the transition to the world of CDMOs with the Center for Breakthrough Medicine here outside Philadelphia. I saw what CBM was doing and how it kind of aligned with a lot of the sort of career aspirations that I had, looking at the totality of what's going on in this industry. And saw CBM doing some great things, making some nice investments in areas that I agreed with. And ultimately, it just seemed to be a nice synergy between where I wanted to go and what I saw CBM doing.
Great. That's an interesting background, having spent time in the therapy development side and now on the kind of services side. Gives you a valuable insight, I have a feeling, on both sides of that coin. Can you tell us a little bit more about CBM, kind of where that business is in its development? I remember visiting the site now probably almost a little over three years ago, when it was just a concept, I think, and Discovery Labs / CBM had kind of just been conceptualized, and you guys have come a long way since. Would love to know kind of how the progress has been, how many team members you have, the kinds of customers and projects you're working on, whatever you can tell us, you know, that's public information.
Yeah, so see, CBM is a true end-to-end provider of CDMO services for advanced therapies that include both gene and cell. Starting at the very earliest, process development, plasmid manufacturing, feeding into viral manufacturing, which then obviously feeds into cell therapy manufacturing in the traditional CAR-T arrangement, of course. And on the back end of that, we have a business unit that is entirely devoted to testing analytical services to support everything therein, as well as regulatory support across the board for some of those more junior companies that may not have that requisite regulatory support internally. In terms of who we are, we have a strategic investor, SK Pharmteco. December of 2021, they made a sizable Series A investment, $350 million. That has led to some massive growth over the past year. When I joined the company, there were somewhere around 100 people, and we're approaching 400 people at this point in time.
Wow.
So
that's great.
Some really significant growth over the past 12 months.
Yeah, fantastic. And what would you say, I mean, the kind of mission of the company is, obviously there's a massive gap in the market currently of experienced manufacturing, both talent and organizations that really know how to develop products, you know, the D in the CDMO, but also then ultimately manufacture them. you know, what is the vision for the company to, you know, where do you see the company maybe in 5 years or 10 years? What's the hope?
Yeah. So the mission is very straightforward. You can find this on any of our marketing paraphernalia. It's to save lives through accelerating the development manufacturing of these advanced therapies. It's no secret that making these things is difficult. And we're really looking to fill the void that has been pronounced over the past 12 months and even longer, to be quite honest. But, you know, we're seeing reports in publications like the Wall Street Journal and Endpoints where patients are literally dying waiting on these advanced therapies simply because there's not enough capacity in the market. And, you know, we at CBM are doing everything we can to fill that gap. We have 700,000 square feet of space here that is currently built, and we're expanding out every day to accommodate what the market needs and to make sure that those patients are getting the therapies that they're waiting on.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, dovetails nicely with the mission of ORI, as you know, which is to enable widespread patient access to life-saving cell and gene therapies. You know, it's the same thing from a different coin or a different side of the coin potentially. And what makes it so hard? I mean, I guess we've been lucky enough to have experienced guests like yourself on the podcast prior to now. We had Mike Paglia from Elevate Bio as an example, Rahul Singhvi from Resilience. There's this kind of new generation of CDMOs that are thinking about the advanced therapy space maybe in new ways, in ways that incorporate things like digital. I think recently you guys announced a couple of digital partnerships, one with, I believe, Autolimus. Is that right?
Yep.
One of our friends here in London. Would love to know how you guys, you know, kind of think differently about either the CDMO business, but also its application to advanced therapies.
Yeah, you know, it's a loaded question. You know, I think we see things differently. You know, there are a lot of quote end-to-end CDMOs out there in the competition. But the one thing that's certainly unique to CBM at present is that all of it is located on a single site. So there's the elimination of all the logistical hurdles, you know, from a client perspective. You know, in many cases, you can get your plasmid from the Midwest, and then that plasmid needs to undergo release, and then it goes to some lentiviral provider, and they have to do their own QC. And so there's a lot of time that's lost in this value stream. And internally, I interface with our head of viral vector daily. Our PD, head of PD is just beneath me in his office. And so we interface every day. And I think that really eliminates a lot of the logistical complexities that other CDMOs bring to the table because of the way that they're structured. Another, I think, big advantage that CBM offers is that we're purposely building our facilities in the sense that they're commercial grade from the very start. There are a sizable number of CDMOs who offer companies the ability to come in and they run through their clinical stage drug development, but eventually have to, if they're successful, and of course everybody plans to be or wants to be successful, then eventually have to deal with the headache of moving that out. So, you know, as we bring partners into our facility, it's literally a home forever if they so choose. And then, of course, you know, we're on this this campus that, you know, I know you visited. It's 200 acres. And so there's an unlimited, virtually unlimited ability to continue to expand. And so as we, you know, I should say that I've been with the company for about a year, but as my colleagues who have been here longer really sat down to think about how they could make a better CDMO, these were things that were very calculated as part of that long-term remit to make sure that we're going to be one of the major suppliers of advanced therapies over the next 5 to 10 years, because we're building in that longevity and eliminating a lot of the bottlenecks and hurdles that other CDMOs may bring to the table.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. When we were on site not that long ago, we discussed a bit about your kind of thoughts around digital and the importance of digital. I'm curious if you'd kind of enlighten our audience a little bit about how you guys are thinking about these issues. We understand the obvious limitations of paper-based processes and paper-based QC and QA, you know, batch release that makes it incredibly difficult. How are you guys trying to front run some of those bottlenecks? You know, and then the way I kind of talk about this issue, and you may have sort of heard me say this, is, you know, no matter how efficient we get the manufacturing process up front, if we're batch releasing an individual product by hand on a 500-page paper batch record, that's always going to be a bottleneck. We have to fix that bottleneck as well. Just pushing the bottlenecks downstream doesn't help us increase the throughput of the entire system, which, you know, it would take to achieve both of our collective mission, which is to get more patients treated. So I wonder how you guys are thinking about some of those challenges, which I think are looming on the horizon.
Yeah. It's so this is an area that we spent an extensive period of time working with Jeet Sarkar from our head of IT, really trying to understand what it is that we need to be successful as we scale our operations. You know, I think there are other companies, both CDMOs as well as innovator companies, who have decided that they'll get to an MES system or electronic batch record system at a point when it makes more sense for them, whatever that might be. And for us, it made more sense to build that as part of our baseline operational procedures from the very beginning. So when we go live for cell therapy manufacturing in Q2 of this year, there will be electronic batch records supporting all of that for many of the reasons that you've kind of intimated here, Jason. You know, just the ability to release by exception, the digitization of the data is just the beginning of what we can do over the long term, right? We're really looking at these different software capabilities and what they can do from a patient scheduling perspective. You know, especially in the world of autologous, this becomes something that is a real logistical nightmare. But
yeah,
tracking of materials within the facility, there's just so many things that if you get too far along with paper processing, it becomes really difficult then to disrupt the flow of your operations to go back and make it better. And we see this, you know, a lot. You know, I think the most obvious from the way that I simply think are websites that were built 10 and 12 years ago were very good at that point in time. And because they weren't forward thinking, now they're no longer functional. And what we're trying to do is really think about where this market is headed over the next 5 to 10 years and build things, systems and processes in such a way that we're future-proofing our business and making it streamlining for the patients as well as for our partners.
Yeah, no, it's a great forward-looking view and one that we share, obviously, and discussed a lot about last time we were together. I think the first hurdle is to kind of digitize the data, capture it, structure it, put it in a place that it's useful and make sure it can be in all the places it needs to be, whether it's the e-batch record or some other place. And then taking that data and making sense of it is the next step, right? It's how do we actually create value out of it, create information for you and your teams to make better, faster, cheaper products, better processes more quickly, and then ultimately to deliver insights to say, actually, you know, with all these data points and all these processes running, it's super difficult for, you know, a head of PD or someone on the shop floor, as it were, to really see across all of that, across all the forest for the trees. And there are systems now, you know, Ori's integrating with systems similar to ours, like BenchLink and other types of providers that actually were able to extract that data, turn it into insight for our partners. And I think, you know, people that are forward looking on the front foot, prepared for that now, we'll be way ahead as we sort of move into that in the next few years. So it's great to hear your continuing commitment to that. I also wanted to ask about, obviously, right now, at least the D again in the CDMO business can be quite human resource intensive. You know, you need a lot of expertise. You need a lot of people that know what they're doing to develop these processes. We hear a lot about the talent shortage out there in the world in CGT and not having enough talent to kind of do some of these things. I wonder how you guys think about talent, and, you know, you're in a a biotech hub. And I don't know if you, does Silicon Valley extend out to where you are? I'm sure it does.
Yeah, we try to say that.
the marketers got a hold of that one, but I think it's great. But I wonder how you think about this kind of, you know, because obviously Ori's part of the movement towards, you know, closed automated processes and automation to allow your staff to do the high value activities rather than the sort of more manual manipulations. But how do you think about the integration? A, where do you get the talent that you need? How do you develop it? And also, how does it integrate with maybe the future vision around automation?
To be fair, it's one of the bigger challenges that we have with the level of growth that I described earlier on the call. You know, at some level, we as an industry, not just CBM, but the entire industry, have to rely on just organic growth of talent, right? This is an exciting area, and there is an influx of young individuals taking this as a career path. And so those folks will be coming. But until then, we have to come up with innovative ways to utilize the talent that's there, cross-train individuals. You know, that's something that we're big on here at the Center for Breakthrough Medicine. You know, taking folks who have, say, viral vector experience and utilizing a lot of that, the GMP work experience in the clean room, and then moving them over to cell therapy. Likewise, you know, one of the things that we've done here at CBM is really, and this goes to the immediate question that you had asked around development. There's quite a bit of innovator experience here, myself included, right? I've got a dozen years of experience from big pharma, not in the CMC space, but in the R&D space. And we're building out R&D capabilities to support platform processes that then feed into that development. And so the folks in PD then, you know, these guys live beside one another. They train with one another and get to understand you know, what each other brings to the table. And, you know, it's one of those scenarios where it's a rising tide that lifts all ships, where that tide is talent and bringing in that talent. And so, you know, we have training academies internally. We have a training academy to train our individuals on the GMP side. And then where that falls short or where there are gaps, of course, you can insource or outsource the training as well. All of which is to say that this is a problem that is everywhere at present. There's just not enough people. And, you know, solutions like what you're building at Ori, I think are going to go a long way to addressing that. And, you know, at the end of the day, humans will never be removed from the manufacturing and the development of these therapies. But the biggest cost driver of COGS in advanced therapies is without question the humans that are involved.
Yeah.
And the more that we can take them out of it, the better it will be for patient access, because COGS go down, of course, but also for, you know, deviations and any other number of hurdles that are encountered because of the human involvement.
Super interesting idea you just kind of stimulated in my mind, John. Coming out of Facilitate, I think Susan Nichols had done a kind of top 10 from 2022 key learnings for advanced therapies. And we were discussing over LinkedIn this idea of that actually R&D equals CMC. Like the two things have to work hand in glove. You've done this kind of meshing your fingers together on the video for anyone's watching on video. But, you know, doesn't considerations around manufacturing have to happen now from the very beginning?
For sure. It was, you know, when I went to Facilitate this year on Monday, there was a workshop on commercialization that ISCT sponsored. And this was a topic that had come up and I believe the phrase, and it's not one that was unique to that, I've heard it before, but start with the end in mind. And when I was at Janssen, for example, and I was head of platform development, very early on, I was working with the downstream individuals on the CMC side to ensure that what I was doing in the R&D space was as compatible as possible and the same wherever possible as what ultimately they were going to be able to do. I can't tell you how much time we see here at CBM where somebody brings what they think is a GMP ready process, and it's nowhere near GMP ready.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you lose so much time where the value proposition of that asset is so high. You know, obviously as you get closer to the clinic, the value proposition increases. And so you're really better served to address a lot of those early integrations between R&D and CMC at the earliest stage, such that when you're closer to the clinic, everything is streamlined. And you'd be surprised. I mean, I think most people would be surprised at how many companies are not doing that right today.
I wouldn't be surprised, because that's kind of our bread and butter, but I think you're right. I mean, it's not the way it used to be. You know, for those of us that grew up in like small molecules or biologics, it's sort of these things were assumed to be able to be overcome later in the process. And I think what we found when we make that assumption, you know, for the first generation CAR T products or even the kind of next generation of innovators, I mean, you talked about the pain and suffering of tech transfer going from facility to facility, or trying to upgrade your process going from academic process into a CDMO, and then from a CDMO kind of clinical gauge or scale process potentially into your own facility. Those transitions or translations are extremely high risk. And thus far, that second translation from a clinical scale process to a commercial scale process has been largely unsuccessful. You know, you look at some of the commercial processes that exist today, they seem to be kind of, you know, an academic process on steroids. It's, you know, brute forcing with lots of people in big buildings. But trying to, you know, you've seen a lot of companies stumble trying to demonstrate to the regulator and others that this process that they've now changed fundamentally from the clinic into a commercial scale to try and address some of these issues at that phase have just been unsuccessful. Either, you know, it's not a process that's the same, or, you know, the assays are different, or they want different types of measurements. And so, you know, this idea of creating a process that ultimately is only ever going to be successful at lab scale, it's a non-starter in my view. And I think you have to address this issue from the very beginning. And, you know, as you said, working hand in glove, R&D and CMC is the only way forward. I'd love to touch back on a topic that we didn't cover much, just around kind of the role of automation and how it helps kind of prime the pump for a lot of these issues. So I'll tell you what I think I mean, and then you can tell me if I'm, you know, off base or whatever. So from a talent perspective, obviously you've got a lot of, you know, talented, highly skilled people, many of them doing very high value tasks. And then you have some of those people who also then have to do what I would consider to be low value kind of rote manufacturing tasks. Things like tube welding and moving fluids around a process isn't that high value. So potentially automation could bring a benefit of freeing up the people to do higher value tasks, whatever those things are. But also from this kind of idea of tech transfer and repeatability, reliability, you know, bringing down cost of goods, improving throughput, all those things that we know automation can do, seem to be even more important or even more crucial for us in this field. You know, we've got living medicines, we've got, you know, short turnaround times where we need to get them back to patients who are, you know, at the end of their road, unfortunately, most of them. So it seems like automation has maybe an even more important role to play here than it has in some of the other. I mean, we've of course done wonders in biologics and other things, but, you know, we really need to get this right in order to make these products accessible. You know, ultimately, what we do now is we produce products that are approvable from a regulatory perspective, but they're not really accessible or affordable. So, you know, what's your view on kind of the role of automation moving forward? And I would just say innovation and technology broadly. It doesn't have to be automation specifically.
Yeah. It's I'll start with the automation piece and then maybe transition over to innovation. You know, from my perspective, and you and I have spoken about this offline, I do believe that CDMOs are going to have a major role in the wider spread adoption of automation processes, simply because we have the, you know, the scale as well as the ability to really introduce it as an opportunity for our partners to streamline their processes and really demonstrate to them where it can enable them from a cost perspective and from an efficiency perspective, right? We're starting to see more of these in the CAR T space, you know, and the way that I see this is CAR T really is the, it's just the trailblazer, right? It's moving and getting rid of obstacles, because these patients, as you've already pointed out, are dying and have no other options. And so this is the POC that cell therapy works. And then what it does, it just creates this path then for all the other cell therapies that we really don't talk about on a daily basis. But the world of regenerative medicine, literally thousands of over 1,000 clinical trials underway, that are going to need similar automation processes. And whatever we can do from a CDMO perspective to enable more mass adoption of the technology, I think it's going to be where things go. In terms of innovation, it's another topic that came up at the ISCT workshop that I described earlier. And you know, there's a problem with innovation, and it's kind of a catch 22. Obviously, we know that we need innovation in this space to do a lot of the things that thematically you and I are describing or discussing right now. The problem is that we have to strike some sort of balance between standardization and innovation, because without the standards, it becomes difficult to innovate around standards. And you know what, it was a topic that actually gained a lot of steam at this workshop, in the sense that as a field, we haven't even agreed on the standards of what an apheresis should be, you know, right?
The very beginning of the process.
If we can't agree globally what the standard for an apheresis product or drug substance or whatever you want to call it is, then it really becomes difficult. Think about the complexities of that entire manufacturing process to innovate around things that we can't agree are the best. And so there needs to be a balance. 100%, we have to be innovating around things, but we also have to agree upon what those standards are. And, you know, I think the low-hanging fruits from, you know, innovations are things like tubing and connectors, universal fittings to get rid of, I know you would love this, right, from your world, is to have less reliance upon, I would love to have less reliance upon single suppliers, but from your world, as far as building automation to bring together various unit operations, having a universal fitting seems like a very easy solution. And yet we can't even get there. So it's an interesting topic that I think we could probably talk for hours on. But that balance of standardization versus innovation is one that the field collectively has to address in order to really make major strides in this area.
I've had this discussion a couple of times with a couple of different folks, and often it's kind of landed that, you know, maybe the industry's a little early to set standards today. But I equate it to, and I don't know that I agree with that, but I equate it to, I mean, maybe an American football reference. So now I've lived in London enough that I call it American football now. but you know, it's almost like you're playing the game, but you haven't decided what the rules are, you know? So there's innovation going from a running, you know, a wing T running back oriented defense to a, you know, West Coast passing offense. Maybe we haven't even decided if it's 10 yards for a first down and whether or not, you know, you can play out of bounds or not. So I think there are some standards we could decide today. This is what good looks like. Let's put the rules of the game down and say, okay, everyone agrees these are the rules of the game. And then we can innovate within that framework. But it is a bit the Wild West. And that's not helpful, I don't think, for innovation or for us to kind of progress the industry, rather than just letting everybody do their own thing. And I think the way it relates to this conversation in particular, I feel, is that as I understand it, and I've never worked in a CDMO business, so tell me if I'm way off base again here, but oftentimes it used to be maybe the client would come in and they would say, this is what we want you to do for us. We want you to, you know, get this process IND ready, or we want you to, you know, fix that piece or do that bit or help us understand this. More and more what I'm hearing from innovators like yourselves is that we want to have a very well a kind of a quiver full of weapons that we deploy against these kinds of problems that we well understand, that are well characterized, and that we know how to to essentially deploy them to solve these kinds of problems. So we don't have to go back and reinvent the wheel every time, because it seems like everyone's reinventing the wheel over and over again, when in fact, if we had some technologies, strategies, innovations that we said that your team knows real well and knows that they work, they could say, well, let us demonstrate to you how, you know, running this in a bit of a different way, approaching this problem in a different bit of a different fashion, we can actually save a bunch of time and, you know, help you get to the point you're trying to get to, you know, faster and maybe less expensively. Do you think that's a pipe dream where, you know, people like yourselves were able to say, like, give us your process. We'll apply our knowledge and technology to it, and we'll show you that we can deliver deliver your outcomes, whatever you want.
It's most certainly not a pipe dream. I would say that 80% of the customers who come to us with processes, whether they're locked or not, in most cases, locked processes go untouched with the understanding that maybe in the background there are some improvements that we can make in line with what you're describing, Jason. But we typically don't edit those protocols, those processes, simply because they're typically clinical stage, mid-clinical stage. We don't want to mess with it for all the reasons that everybody would understand.
Sure.
However, there are quite a few folks with unlocked processes where they'll come to us and say, are you aware of a bioreactor that can achieve this kind of scale? And, you know, our PD team is actively interfacing. You know, there's always the, everybody understands the client-facing work that a CDMO does, but there's a lot of equipments, company exercises that we're going through where we're evaluating various bioreactors and, you know, something as simple as a welder is to understand, mm-hmm. you know, how they're differentiated from one another such that we can make these our platform processes to address exactly what you've described. And that is, hey, we've got a ready-made solution here. We know it. Here's a bunch of data sets that we've generated for processes like yours. And, you know, and then it's just a matter of saying, okay, we could probably have a preliminary data set in this amount of time. And you go from there. And I think the majority of innovator companies, particularly those that are younger or maybe more biotech than big pharma. Big pharma typically has a more well-baked set of processes when they come to us. Those folks are really wanting those types of solutions because they don't have the bandwidth to do the evaluations that you're describing. So it is something that we can and do offer as a result.
Yeah, I think it's a massive value add for the industry, for experts like yourselves to have a good view of what are all the levers we can pull to try and, you know, solve this problem. And I wonder if you think there, you know, if we're able to kind of digitize and then ultimately standardize some of these processes, there's a big debate, as you know, going on in the industry around centralized manufacturing versus maybe a multi-site or decentralized approaches. You know, can you imagine a future where maybe, you know, you guys are doing manufacturing for the Northeast for a partner, and then maybe, you know, our friends down at CTMC in Houston are doing it for, you know, the Southwest. And it seems to me when we have personalized medicines, this idea of being able to bring manufacturing closer to patients could make a lot of sense. And I wonder what your thought is on the considerations around that. I mean, obviously the regulatory construct today doesn't allow for that, but there is an openness of the FDA. They did a workshop for 3 days. I don't know if you attended before Christmas, thinking about, like, if we wanted to do this, how would we even go about it? And I wonder if you think that's a valid approach, at least to think about.
Well, it's certainly a valid approach. I mean, I think that, you know, there have been studies done already, and the field is early, where manufacturing just unduly affects access mm-hmm. to certain demographics, right? So we need to get to a point where we're democratizing these therapies in such a way that they're easily accessible to anybody that needs them. And most certainly, the easiest way to do that is to decentralize manufacturing to an extent where that's possible. And so I guess the question is, how do we make it possible? And I'm not sure I see a future where, CTMC is the Southwest and we're the Northeast. But I do think that there will be an ability for the folks who do this well, that is the manufacturing end of things, to expand into markets. You know, mm-hmm. we're, you know, be remiss. I talked earlier about being a single site, but you know, the long-term goal is to have a presence in Europe and Asia and on the West Coast. And those things will eventually happen when it's right for us as a business. Once we have the foundational systems in place, it will make sense to do that and to further spread our wings, so to speak. And so I think it happens eventually, Jason, but the mechanism by which it does occur, and I'd be curious to hear what the 3-day workshop, I wasn't there, but I'm guessing there's no solution that was proctored as part of that.
No, not yet. Not a lot of answers, a lot of questions, but I think, you know, they did invite industry comment, which we sent some stuff in and as well. But I think also, I mean, thinking about this in the frame that you just put down, you know, we've got a shared partner in Achilles Therapeutics, which is a manufacturer here in the UK. They've got 2 clinical trial indications that they're running, I believe, here. You know, what one of the benefits we talk about kind of as we think about the ORI platform is the ability to tech transfer a protocol literally with the push of a button from one site to the next. You know, potentially we could help a therapy developer client, you know, land in a place like CBM, you know, very easily with that push of the button and get the, if we've taken some of those manual steps out and taken a lot of that training burden out, potentially they could be up and running, you know, tech transfer these days. I don't know. What would you estimate? 6 to 9 months, maybe 9 to 12, depending.
Yeah. We're quoting in general. I mean, if it's a routine, semi-routine, anywhere from 5 to 7 months. So that's about right.
Yeah. 6-ish months. So, you know, if we can save, let's say 3 months or more on a tech transfer that happens probably 2 or 3 times during a development process, at least, you know, that's years of a development timeline potentially saved. So these kinds of technology, we talked about digital, that's absolutely required to do anything like that. We talked about, you know, automation also, and then the expertise that organizations like yours bring to the table is critically important to achieving, you know, anything close to that idea of, you know, multi-coast, multi-country, even multi-site manufacturing. But we'll stay tuned to see how that evolves over time. So, John, before I let you go, I wanted to discuss one of the hot topics that's kind of facing the industry today, which is really this kind of make versus buy discussion, or buy versus build, as we often say. I think there was a move a couple years ago where many therapy developers went and invested the money to build out their own capacity. And then we've seen many of those over the last 18 months or maybe, you know, 2 years, you know, post the bust of which is happening now, post 21, really back away from that, you know, not realizing maybe the operational experience and expertise it takes to run that facility, the cost associated with running those kinds of facilities, particularly for an early stage company. How do you guys think about this debate? I mean, I think obviously you've invested the time and money in creating a footprint, which seems to be more and more appreciated by developers as a way to kind of bring a flexible approach to their development and their manufacturing. But, you know, what's your thought on the kind of evolution of that discussion, buy versus build?
Yeah, it's topical, right? We saw as recent as this morning in Still Bio, cutting a lot of their workforce, and they've got I believe it's a $37 million facility they bought outside Los Angeles that they're looking to sell or sublet. Yes. because when times are flush, when the capital markets are friendly, you can do things like buy a $40 million facility and plan on success. But when they're the way they are today, and certainly I'm not pointing any fingers at Instill. There are a lot of companies much bigger than Instill. Novartis comes to mind as being one of those as well that have just overbuilt. These things are expensive, right? It's not just the manufacturing that's been the focus of a lot of what you and I have described, but it's also just the infrastructure. Building the infrastructure and paying highly trained individuals to be ready to create these drugs is super expensive. And, you know, as, you know, you think about, you know, a lot of where we are in the world of cell therapy, folks are going into early stage clinical trials where there are 10 to 12 patients where the FDA says, hey, you can only put one person in your trial this month. And then if that does well, 30 days from now, you can look for a second patient. And if you start thinking about the bang for your buck, so to speak, and what it would take to build, maintain, and then actually manufacture, it doesn't make a lot of sense for early stage companies that are otherwise cash restricted. And so, you know, obviously there's a big outlay of cash from our end and capital building, not just the facility, but also keeping folks paid. But there's a, you know, obviously the CDMO model works well when you have a critical mass of clients to really take advantage of that. And, you know, this is where we're making, making those investments with the understanding that the market need is there and that we'll be able to deliver for the smaller companies as well as the larger companies. You know, that's another area that, you know, we're seeing. I'll be honest that when I left my previous employer, I expected 90% of the CDMO world to be biotech. That's really not. There's a big interest in big pharma to outsource key aspects of their portfolio. And this is an area that I think they understand that maybe we can do it better simply because of our exposure. You know, that's the thing about being at a CDMO. You don't just see one complex process, you see dozens of complex processes. And to the point that you made earlier, Jason, solutions come with processes that maybe others aren't thinking about. So it's an interesting place to be.
Yeah. And I think that kind of bringing flexibility to that infrastructure, that investment that's been made, because as we discussed, it's unlikely, and maybe I'm making an assumption here, it's unlikely that, you know, the average customer that you service earlier in their development is going to want to stay in a CDMO forever. You know, it's likely that at some point when they get regulatory approval, or maybe at some point after, they're going to, you know, want to control their own manufacturing. And that's good for the industry. That's good for, you know, that means that company and that product's been successful. But ultimately, the ability to benefit from your expertise and your infrastructure, and then also at the right time, you know, move out from that and stand on their own two feet, you know, having this flexible approach. You know, we're thinking about how do we potentially allow our technology to exist in lots of different environments, in an academic research environment, in a CDMO environment, maybe in a modular, you know, pod solution from, you know, our partners at a G-Con or a Germ-Free, you know, so that there's lots of different choices and ways to de-risk various elements of your manufacturing pipeline or your development pipeline so that you could go into a CDMO and then go out again if you wanted to, and maybe go, you know, into an academic center for research. But I think flexibility is critical. You know, what we haven't had yet in the industry is really flexible approaches. It's been very sort of like, you know, lots of square pegs trying to jam into round holes that were inflexible, you know, and I think that ultimately, hopefully, will allow us to live up to the promise, you know, the big idea of what we're trying to accomplish here, which is ultimately, you know, one of the things that I say often annoyingly, probably for the people around me, is that, you know, we need to measure things by the right measuring stick. And for me, success is, it's not the, you know, 6 approved CAR T products, or the last number I saw was over 2,000 clinical trials that are underway. Those are great leading indicators, but how many patients have been successfully treated? That's the number that we should be focused on. We've done a little bit of research on this, and we look back 5 years from the approval of Yescarta and Kymriah, and looked at how many patients have been treated. And it's less than 15,000 over 5 years. Now, that's better than 14,000, but it's less than 2% of the patient population that could have been treated potentially, that could have benefited from these therapies. So there's more work to do on that, you know, patient access piece we talked about, and making sure that we can, as you said, democratize access for patients, because that ultimately is the measure of success that I think that really matters.
I completely agree with the sentiment. It's something that obviously we talked about earlier. And, you know, I think what's going to happen is, you know, the first thing we're going to do is lower COGS. And then the understanding then is, do we lower them to a place where democratization is possible? Mm-hmm. And if it's not, then I think some of the things we're looking at now in terms of alternative payer models become more in the forefront, things like outcomes-based payment systems with rebates based on efficacy or failure. There are a lot of conversations that are ongoing now that personally I think are premature because the field has a lot of evolution to undergo. Mm-hmm. But there will come a point in time when I think those are the right conversations to have.
Yeah, agreed. I think we all understand that, you know, $500,000 to $4 million products are probably unsustainable as we get into larger indications. It just ultimately can't be afforded by healthcare systems. So we need to do something about cost of goods. You know, prices will follow and market access will follow that. I agree.
That's right.
One final thought, if I could ask you, we've almost had you for the full hour, so very much appreciate you spending the hour with us. If you had, I don't know if you've got a crystal ball there under your desk somewhere, if you, you know, pull it out and dust it off. Love to know what you see. What do you see for the industry over the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years? When we look back from that perspective, what will we have accomplished, or what do you hope for from sitting in your chair today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I wish I did have a crystal ball. This is one of those things that go awfully bad in 5 to 10 years.
We promise not to bring it up in 10 years. Don't worry. Look,
I'm bullish on the industry. I think that. I know that cells can do things that small molecules and antibodies can't, right?
For sure. We've proven that.
Only begun to scratch the surface of what they can do on top of it. But in terms of what I see in the next 5 to 10 years, I think, you know, some of these things we're already beginning to see some early signs. One thing that's assuredly happening, and we got news earlier this week, I believe, that Carvykti, for example, is efficacious in earlier lines of prior in multiple myeloma patients. This is the next most logical step, right?
Yes.
We didn't see any hard data there yet. I suspect we'll see something maybe at ASCO, or I don't know if they're going to, probably ASCO is where we'll see that. But, that opens the doors for getting these guys into a much larger population. And does some interesting things for the field. I think the other area that we're going to continue to see success around, a polarizing topic, but one that I feel confident, is we're going to figure out the allo thing. There are naysayers, including some of the biggest names in the industry, who don't think that allo is ultimately a solution. I'm of the opinion that there will be allo in this space. And it doesn't mean that allo will overtake auto. I think there's a place where they can mutually coexist and benefit from one another. But allo is going to happen, whether it's an alpha beta T cell or a gamma delta or an NK, there's a cell effector out there that will be tolerated in an allogeneic environment. And there may be need to be some gene editing tweaks that need to occur along the way, and those will eventually be identified. But what that does then is really pave the way for additional conversations around standardization of quality, starting material, tying back clinical data to the success, the clinical success to that starting material, and being able to bridge that gap. This is where, going back 45 minutes, Jason, the digitization of the data becomes so important, because you have it then, and then you can go back and say, oh, we didn't see that then, but now we have it, which would have been impossible in a paper-based environment, or at least a lot more difficult. And then ultimately, and I touched on this earlier, as these things happen, as you get success in earlier phases of trials, and allo comes here and starts to pave the way, then it opens the door for all the other things in the regenerative medicine space that currently there is a need, but it isn't a life or death need. And as we, lower the prices of these things, become better at manufacturing with, automation and some of the other stuff we talked about along the way, now all of a sudden we really see the promise of this modality, where cell therapies are going to do things that a lot of people can't even think about at the moment. But it's an exciting, exciting field, and I'm very happy to be in the middle of it all. And it's a humbling existence, right? I mean, I think you probably feel the same way. It's just every day I feel like I'm learning something new, but it's also an exciting place to be.
For sure, for sure. Well, an optimistic view of the future I share where we have accessible products from maybe multiple approaches that are standardized, that are digitized, but really it's all about making them accessible at the end of the day. No matter what route we take, patients have to be able to get access to these incredible medicines. So thank you for that optimism and for your time. It's been great to see you, and I hope to see you again in three dimensions soon. Thank you for listening to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. To keep up with the latest in cell and gene therapy and follow us on our mission to manufacture brighter futures for patients, head to the show notes to follow us on social media or visit us at OriBiotech.com.